How are you doing today, Johnny?
I'm doing good. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. I'm very excited to kick off this new series. So to give you a bit of a background to what we do, Crypto Sapiens started as a podcast, and it's slowly become a platform where we basically lend our platform to creators to come on and develop their own series. We have people like Eureka John in the back end who are experts at making us sound and look good on these podcasts. And so like him, there's a few other professionals that help Crypto Sapiens amplify everything that we do here. So we thought, why not open this up to the wider community so that anyone who wants to start a podcast can do so with, you know, very little kind of upfront knowledge, skill, or cost. And so, yeah, we've kind of developed this little system here that works for us, where we bring on different creators for a season or a series. Alongside with them, I create a bunch of little series too that try to touch on different elements of the Web3 space so that it is interesting to a niche audience. We just closed out On-Chain Alpha last week, and that explored the world of decentralized data. And we looked at different projects that are building tools. We also talked to their founders, CEOs, thread writers on Farcaster, on X. And yeah, that was actually quite fun, quite interesting. And now, today is the first episode of Crypto Consumer Chronicles, where we're going to be exploring the world of consumer crypto. And we're going to be talking to people like you to understand, first of all, what does that term mean? And second of all, how do we like bridge crypto to people without necessarily talking about the financialization of it, but really at its core, the technology? And I think it's just really awesome to start with you because, well, first of all, been following your work on Farcaster, your podcast, which you can talk all about everything that you do, but also most recently, the accelerator that was started by Hypersub and Coinbase Wallet. So we're going to cover all those things. But before we get started, I'm going to run through a quick intro here. Welcome to everyone to the first ever Crypto Consumer Chronicles episode or podcast, if you will, where we are going to be, as I said earlier, navigating the world of consumer crypto with the people who are building it. And today we are very lucky to have Johnny Mack, aka Nonlinear.eth, with us on the show. He is the founder, CEO of Fabric, creators of CrowdFi, creators of Hypersub. Also, before we get started, I want to make sure that I let you know to sign up to our newsletter at cryptosapiens.xyz and thank the supporters that make this all possible: Mosaic Labs, the Optimism Collective, and Bankless DAO. More about them later. So without further ado, Johnny, give us an introduction. Who are you?
Oh, well, thank you, first of all, for having me. I really appreciate it. It's an honor to be on the inaugural episode. So very, very cool. Who am I? I'm the founder of a company called Fabric. We, as you said, we built a product called CrowdFi, and we built another product called Hypersub. Hypersub is our kind of primary focus, and it's NFT subscriptions in a nutshell. So basically, the idea is you can mint time on an NFT, and that positive balance of time gets you access to allow lists, group chats, IRL experiences, and so on. And so that's been going well. You know, I think it's been kind of like drinking from a fire hose the past few months as that started to kind of click for people. And so, yeah, that's kind of the like high level overview of who I am, what I'm doing, kind of where we're at. I can talk about my background if you're interested in that, or I can, you know, jump into some more specific like Hypersub stuff, whatever direction you want to go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I guess I want to paint a picture to the people that are listening to this podcast to try to understand also too how people even discover crypto, right? Because I think for to be honest, like our audience primarily is people who are just discovering crypto. I think a lot of that is by design, the way that we initially started this podcast. So we do want to make sure that people who are listening understand that it doesn't always start with crypto as in the token. Sometimes we're just technology nerds. I can speak for that about myself. You know, I certainly discovered it because I saw parallels with the work that I was already doing in the traditional tech stack. And I was really interested to see how the internet could scale or the web could scale. So tell us a little bit about like where you came from prior to like doing anything in crypto, or did you start your career in crypto?
No, I didn't start my career in crypto. Well, before crypto, I was working at Google on a bunch of different projects. I mean, I worked there for 6 years, and so I was one of the really early designers on the cloud product and kind of helped build and scale that team from like 3 to 80. I co-founded Google Domains. I worked on Chrome OS and Android system UI. I worked on some security stuff there. So had kind of a like long career in tech, sort of pre-crypto. Before that, I worked at HP on WebOS. I guess I got into crypto from a podcast that I was a huge fan of. I don't listen to it as much anymore, but I still love the host. It's this podcast called Econ Talk. And he had someone on, I think I was listening to this in like 2014, and he had someone on talking about Bitcoin. And I'd always been kind of an economics nerd. And so it just captured my imagination because it was like the intersection of these two things. It was technology and economics. And I remember thinking like, oh, this sounds interesting. And so like I went home, like searched it, like went, you know, found Coinbase and then bought some Bitcoin for like $200 and sort of didn't think much about it beyond that, but sort of tracked it in the news. And then I remember years later, the Ethereum crowdfund happening and paying attention to that and like buying some Ethereum when it was like, you know, $20, buying some ETH. And it wasn't until I think like you could start to kind of do stuff, you know, that I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like there's actually like an economy here. There's like activity. I think so around 2017, you know, like that time frame, like DeFi summer, there was a lot of interesting things happening. And a lot of my friends were, you know, either working in crypto or were like very actively kind of playing with it. And so I remember in 2017, I decided like, okay, I'm going to leave Google and I'm going to go work full-time in crypto. And that was kind of the beginning of my crypto, I'd say, career. You know, it's an interesting question you're asking around how do people get into it? And I think there's a, so far as I can see, there's sort of two entry points. One is the computer and one is the casino, kind of as Chris Dixon puts it. I think that the computer entry point is for people that are just kind of nerdy, you know, and they're nerdy in some dimension. They're interested in economics, they're interested in computer science, they're interested in like, you know, this sort of frontier of user experience. There's some kind of, you know, more or less technical aspect that draws them in. The other, you know, kind of entry point, I think, is just like, you know, it's the economic opportunity. I mean, it's almost like a cliche at this point, like the Uber driver, you know, who's got a hot tip on like whatever, the next big meme coin. And, you know, they don't give a fuck about any of the nerdy shit. And I think that's great. I don't think they should have to. In fact, I think success for our industry looks like not having to know or care about the technology that powers these sort of novel user experiences that are emerging. So that's certainly what we're working towards, you know, and I think that's what, once we get there, I think as an industry will represent, I don't know, a kind of maturity milestone, which is that the tech has been largely obfuscated. And instead of talking about the tech, you're talking about the outcomes that the tech produces.
Yeah, so there's definitely a lot to unpack there. I think one of the things that I really wanted to go back to, which you just recently talked about, which was that computer versus casino analogy. And I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think that there's people who are strictly gamers, if you will. They like to play games and they like the idea of being able to take part in a global, you know, economy and a global scale game. And they come in by way of that. And I mean, I think that that's true, because if you look at least how a lot of crypto tends to grow attention-wise, it tends to be around these things that have some financialization attached to it, right? So to be fair, NFT, the standard, the technology had existed for a long time, but it wasn't until like these collectible NFTs came around, PFPs as they're known, or profile pictures, it drove a lot of attention. A lot of its value was due to the scarcity model that was applied to them, but also through some very genius tokenomics aside from that, that drove a lot of value. But in when you look at what happened overall, you look at this concept of DAOs kind of also being born alongside that, which was, how can we organize all these people that now have a shared interest, which is this one NFT or a collection of NFTs? And because of that, now you're looking at how can we govern ourselves as a decentralized organization, as a headless organization, if you will. So that, you know, from, I think, some of these maybe casino games, you also start seeing some of these computer games come into effect, and vice versa, right? Because the computer games, like the creation of these standards like NFTs, ERC 721s and so on, 1155s, now you have the creation of these casinos. So it's almost like a virtuous cycle, right? Like the casino players create challenges for the computer players, and the computer players then create systems for the casino players to leverage and grow. So it's this cycle keeps growing, and we're seeing as each cycle really comes and goes, there are new challenges and new opportunities that come with it. So where then did your experience with everything that you were doing previous lead you then to say, well, you know what, there's a problem here that Fabric can solve?
Well, I think it's a good framing, you know, that, and I like the framing of like casino games and computer games. The way that I think about this is like this Goldilocks zone. Like, I think that if you're too much the casino, if it's too sort of degenerate gambling, I think that you're not going to make it. And if it's too purist, if it's too moral high ground, better than thou, you know, we don't want to do any gambling, we don't want any kind of speculation or shared upside, then you're also not going to make it. And I think as an industry, we're, you know, a lot of the people who are really kind of heads down in building, I think whether they know it or not, are kind of in search of this apex, like in search of this Goldilocks zone, which is you want both, because these are what the primitives inside of crypto sort of facilitate, which is programmable value, shared value. It's this novel kind of dimension that we can now innovate on. And so the question is like, where do you want to be? And I think that it's, you know, nobody knows the answer. It's a stochastic kind of random walk that we're all on. Everyone's sort of, you know, like Dracula, for example, is like looking at what we've done, and we've looked at what Dracula has done. And, you know, like you have things like FriendTech, and I think everyone's kind of paying attention to everybody else and trying to gather information and use that information as inputs on the sort of next set of decisions that they make. But I think that's the future of, you know, of consumer crypto, is like really, really homing in on that Goldilocks zone, so that it's like, it's as fun and engaging for the people who are really oriented around the economic opportunities, as well as the people who are like maybe less interested in that and just want to have like, you know, a novel user experience, or, you know, like an IRL experience, or like a unique fan experience, or whatever, some kind of consumer experience that's just like new and fresh and delightful. As far as, you know, the, like how my background, I guess, like has prepared me or has oriented me in crypto, it's like, you know, I think the way I think about this is that I feel like I'm a little bit of a rare bird in the industry, just because I am both experienced and optimistic. And I feel like you get kind of like that. There's not a lot of overlap in that Venn diagram. And so what I mean is that a lot of people who have like a lot of experience, like say 20 years or more working in tech, the vast majority of those people, number one, are extremely skilled, you know, and at that point are pretty much in the prime of their career. The vast majority of those people think crypto is a fucking joke. You know, they think it's a scam. They think it's like, it's tech in search of a problem. I mean, blah, blah, blah. They just write it off. You then have this sort of second cohort, which is like people that are young and optimistic, and they see the future very clearly and they're excited to build it. And but they don't have a lot of experience, you know? So they're like having to learn stuff kind of the hard way. And so what I think that the best teams in crypto are comprised of people who have both of those properties. They're both experienced. They've kind of been in the game a long time. They know what they're doing. They've learned the lessons, and they're like extremely optimistic about the future of crypto, and they have high conviction, and they're willing to be low status while they build out this future. So I guess like in terms of, you know, how my past has prepared me, I certainly think that's one aspect of it. I think also too, I don't know, just working in design, you know, for a long time, like, you know, you're just sort of obsessed with making things simpler. And I think crypto is very complex kind of by default. And I think what it tends to do is it nerd snipes people, and it kind of galaxy brains people. So you come in, you have some idea for whatever, a feature or product, you start working on it, and then you kind of overdo it. You over-design it. And I think part of that is that there are so many knobs to turn in crypto. There's all these dimensions, as I've said. There's kind of this behavioral economics, incentives. There's all these technical constraints that you kind of have to use creativity to kind of overcome. And so I think like, you know, having to constantly kind of come back to first principles, which is just like, make it easy, make it dumb, make it so that anybody can do it. I guess like it's the same sort of core principles that I come back to over and over and over and have been for many years that I find anchoring inside of crypto. I think it's, like I said, a lot of people can just end up adrift in this ocean of complexity, and they just go too far. I mean, we've done that many times. You know, something that I like to attribute to Cooper Turley and to 0x Designer, who both kind of told me this in their own way, which is just like, less galaxy brain, more smooth brain. You know, like, just make it dumber. You think you've made it simpler, make it simpler again. And I think that's like my one piece of advice to myself every day and to other people is just like, make it simpler. So yeah, that's I'd say like how my background has kind of prepared me for this.
Yeah. By the way, I wanted to make sure that I didn't get too far, but since you brought it back, so it gives me a perfect opportunity to note on something on your background, and that is three books, two of which the names are pretty clear, Sagmeister and Saul Bass. You were just talking about design. So prior to coming into the crypto space, I worked, I basically own and operate an IT consultancy. My clients were primarily, and at one point, all architects and designers. So I was heavily influenced by their processes, right? Their design processes. And I'm familiar with those names because I think that each are leaders in their own space, in their own ways. Saul Bass, for anybody who doesn't know, probably one of the most premiered graphic designers of our times, all the most influential movie posters of an era you can really see his work. And yeah, just, I feel like that's really interesting. And then Sagmeister in his own way, I think architecturally, but also in other ways, I think he's pretty influential. So I'd love to see that kind of in your background, because it also is coming to the fore through the conversation. And it's this idea of like you said, first principles, but also like good design thinking. And you talked about 0x Designer, which I think the way that he's exploring the crypto space, the Web3 space, is quite interesting and quite novel and important, right? Because he's looking at it from a design perspective. Like, look, you have a lot of technology that works, but for the most part is inaccessible or irrelevant to the people who aren't necessarily in this space already. So when we talk about bridging a lot of what we're doing to the consumer, right, which this is what this podcast is focusing on, it is not working, or at least it's not working well. So let's talk about the design principles around Hypersub, because the way that I titled this episode was, you know, building the Web3 version of Patreon or something like that with Fabric. And NFT subscriptions, you know, I would say they're quite novel, because at least the way that NFTs have been used in the past have mostly been around IP and collectibles, PFPs, building communities around these. I feel like Hypersub is more so leaning on that latter end, which is community building. But what are some of the things that came into your mind when you were thinking about building Hypersub?
Yeah. The primary motivator was twofold. So the first was, you know, we conceived of and designed and built, the protocol that powers Hypersub really in like the middle of the bear market. And so we're sort of looking around and we're thinking, okay, what are people doing on chain right now? Whatever that is what we should build on top of. And the one thing really like that was like a non-DeFi case that we could see that was pretty obvious was they're minting NFTs. That was like a very clear, it was like one of the very few things that people were kind of continuing to do on chain. So like, okay, the next thing we build should in like the kind of, you know, canonical action that, you know, it should be oriented around is minting an NFT. So like, okay, well then what does that mean? Like, do we want to build, you know, a marketplace? Do we want to build a creation platform? Like, you know, what areas are there, what opportunities are there for innovation, you know, that other people aren't already doing? And, you know, we didn't really see too many opportunities. So we started thinking deeply, okay, well, what do people do with these NFTs? You know, you mint it and then it just kind of sits there and that's it, you know? And in some ways it's maybe kind of a lottery ticket, or, you know, people say, well, you could token gate, you know, you can have these private experiences. You know, you have kind of a network that emerges, but no one's actually doing that. You know, like you don't actually see any of that stuff really happening. What you actually see, you know, especially on Farcaster, is you just like see something in the feed, you mint it, and then you like go about your day. And so we were like, okay, what are like artists and like membership clubs, organizations, like what are some other interesting use cases? And like what we found is that a lot of people are using NFTs as a kind of membership. They're saying, if you mint this NFT, it's going to give you access, you know, for some specified period of time, but it's kind of hard. It's a little bit of a hack, because it'd be like, if you mint this NFT, it's like your annual pass, you know, or it's a mint pass for a specific event, or there's some sort of temporal dimension that they were imbuing to, you know, on the NFT, but that dimension was not sort of like baked into the underlying contract itself. And so, and the worst of this was when you'd see these sort of lifetime, like mint this NFT once and you get this sort of lifetime of access, which in our view is completely asymmetric, you know, unfavorable to the creator, extremely favorable to the person who mints. And so we're like, okay, this time, this like dimension of time is a really interesting design space to explore. Turns out we're not the first people to have this idea. There were like three, I think two or three EIPs that never really got off the ground that were subscription NFTs. And so we were like, okay, well, this is kind of encouraging that, you know, people have had this idea. It seems like something that people have wanted to have happen, but, you know, it just hasn't really gotten there. And so we're like, all right, let's do it. So we committed to doing it. We wrote the contract, started designing Hypersub. we added in these mechanisms for kind of sharing some of the upside. So we added in this notion of subscriber rewards, which is a way that the creator of the contract can allocate a percentage of the subscription revenue to go into an on-chain pool. And the earlier you subscribe and the longer period of time you subscribe for, the greater your percentage share ownership of that pool is. So it allows you to kind of, it's a little bit like a bonding curve, but it's not traded. So it's not priced like one. But it certainly has the same properties and behaviors as a bonding curve, in that the earlier you are to a creator and the more long you are, the more upside exposure that you have. So as that subscription grows and more subscription revenue comes in, the majority of that will flow to you in terms of like what's sitting in the reward pool. So like that was exciting, you know, which is this idea that you can cut people in. That felt like a kind of, you know, novel differentiator between, say, Patreon. And so we also added on-chain referral rewards, so that when you refer somebody, you know, if I refer you, for example, to Alice's subscription and you subscribe, I get whatever percentage Alice has allocated, you know, to refers. And that happens immediately at mint time. It happens on chain, as obviously does the subscriber reward. So that was like a way we're like, okay, these are these interesting hooks for sharing the money that comes in, which again, going back to like, what is crypto good at? You know, programmable value. Okay, great. Well, we should be programming some value then. So we built it, audited it, built Hypersub, designed it. I think the kind of design, the kind of graphic design principles for, I'd say, Fabric generally and Hypersub specifically, is to be as weird and delightful as possible. Those two things are often, you know, there's not often overlap between those two things. Things that are weird are often not delightful, and things that are delightful are rarely really weird. And so I think the intersection of those two is unexpected, and it draws people in, and it's kind of fun. And so that's how, I don't know, that's sort of how I am, you know, it's like, I try to embody that as much as possible. And so having that reflected in kind of the aesthetic of the company and the products is important to me. Yeah. And to be honest, you know, we launched it and nobody gave a fuck. I mean, it kind of just fell flat for months, and it felt like we completely whiffed. And it was, you know, it was, I don't want to say depressing, but it was certainly anxiety producing. Like, I mean, it was awful, to be honest. Like, I think the worst thing that an artist, the worst outcome from an artist's output or from a founder's product is indifference. It's great if people hate it, and it's great if people love it. But in the absence of those two poles, you have no information. And so without any information, you can't make progress, because you just don't know what the fuck to do. And so you're in this sort of place of, well, I guess we could just guess, you know, but then what are you doing? You know, you're kind of just coming up with work, but the market isn't giving you any signal. And so that was pretty much the situation for a few months. And then, you know, just, I think pure luck, like, you know, I made a big commitment to Farcaster kind of in the very early days of Fabric and Farcaster. Like, you know, our companies are of similar ages, and Farcaster's growth essentially just went straight up. And being very, very active on there, you know, I've built up an audience, and, you know, I think that we had an artist, you know, Oxen. He was the first one. He was the only artist of anybody that I talked to who was willing to take a chance and take a risk on creating a Hypersub subscription NFT. And, you know, everyone else I talked to, they'd all ask the exact same question, which is, okay, this sounds cool, but who else is using it? And, you know, it's the classic chicken and egg problem. Oxen was the only one who was just like, hell yeah, I'm in, let's try it. And I think what happened is that as Farcaster grew, you know, Oxen's kind of stock, you know, his reputation and the floor price of his work grew. And so people started looking at sort of the delta between the floor price of his work and the price of his Hypersub. And they're like, oh, this is a no-brainer. I'm going to subscribe to him and I'm going to get these subscriber additions, you know? And so it kind of, you know, that was, once that happened, it was sort of game on. You know, that sent the signal, the kind of bat signal to like other artists and creators in and around the Farcaster ecosystem that this works. I mean, he made, I don't know, something like $100,000 in a very, very short amount of time. And, you know, a large percentage of that is recurring. So then things started to move and it kind of started to click. But yeah, there was a long, I mean, there was like many, you know, I don't know, 2-3 months, which felt like way longer, where, you know, nothing was happening. So yeah anyway, that's kind of a ramble. That's sort of the like.
No, I followed. I tracked it all.
Okay.
So, I mean, for me, kind of the biggest takeaway, I guess there's a few things there that I'd like to go back to as always. But one of the biggest takeaways is like, how do you as a founder then gain the insights necessary to make the right decisions? Or if you need to make any decisions at all in terms of like changing how the product works when you're so early, right? Which I think it's kind of like a big, I'll call it a problem, might be the wrong word, but a big problem for early stage founders working with crypto, that it's such a small niche community that like, if there's a lot of noise and a lot of other things happening, it's easy to get, you know, drowned out in the noise. As far as what you're building, it doesn't matter if like what you're building is really creating anything of value or impact, because there's just so much other things happening. Sometimes you get lost in it, and it, you know, it's, your product is probably fine and it's actually going to solve a problem for one or many people. How did you find your way, I suppose, into like gaining the necessary insights? Was it really just going to those early customers and saying, hey, just try the product? Was it that, like really just boots on the ground trying to get people to use the product? Or did you just start actually making some changes based on like how you would use a product?
You're talking about this period of time where there was just like not a lot happening?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a desperate situation. At least it was for me. And I would consider it one for any founder where, you know, you've, and this is the weird thing about building on chain, which is that like, if you take the view, which we do, which is that what it means to build on chain is that you have to build two things. You have to build a protocol and you have to build a client on top of that protocol. If you build one or the other, you're off course. If you just build a protocol, the reality is that nobody really gives a fuck about that until you build a great user experience on top of it. And people start to actually like use that. Like you demonstrate that the protocol is valuable through usage. So like, if you don't do that, your protocol is essentially worthless. You know, it's like you might have a fucking genius professor coin or white paper or whatever, whatever. But if no one uses it, the market is essentially saying no, thank you. So you have to build a protocol and then you have to build a client, but you can't just build a client. A lot of people, one of my jokes that I like to make is, you know, people say the best way to build on chain is to not build on chain. Just build a client, you know, get information, get signal. And then later you can like build a protocol. I don't buy that. I think that's I think that's fantasy land. To me, that's like, anyone who would advocate for that, it's like, it's super naive. Because the reality is that when you have real users and you have real pressure coming, the idea that you're gonna like go off and like codify that into a protocol, like all it does to me is say like, you have no idea what it means to actually build a protocol then, because like, that's not a simple process. There are exceptions to this. I think Farcaster is a good example. I would also say like, you know, Farcaster raised $30 million. Farcaster has an enormous, like a very big team, like, well, big, I mean, I don't know, it's maybe 12 people or something, but still, that's like not small. There's very few cases where that I think you can point to and say like, oh yeah, they nailed it with that approach. So if you end up in this situation where you're like, well, you've got to build a protocol and the client, then that means you're having to do a ton of work without any information, without any validation, which is like a cardinal sin in software development. But I don't know how else to build. Like, like if you're building on chain, you have to build a smart contract. That requires like time and effort in the absence of information. So it has to be thesis driven. And then you have to build your client, and then you have to go get information. So like, I'm open to suggestions, but I just don't know how else to build on in this very on-chain native way mm-hmm. without taking big risk in that sense. You're taking big time risk. So, okay, let's say that's your baseline. That's what you've established as being kind of the those are table stakes. Great, you've done all that. Now you're in the situation where we were in, which is that there's like no information. What we did, which was we just, you know, I was like DMing people every single day. I was like trying to set up meetings.
Yeah.
And it was getting nowhere. You know, like it was the same thing over and over and over again, which is that people would say, this sounds cool, but let me know when other people are using it. And, you know, good luck.
Yeah.
People were nice, but it was just very clear that this was not, you know, they weren't going to really pay us any attention. I really, you know, we were pretty much, I would say, a month away from like scrapping it. I think we said, all right, like, let's come back from the holiday, you know, let's spend another month kind of grinding, you know, trying to get people to give a shit about this. And if, you know, if they don't, then, you know, we'll build something else. We'll just move on. That's kind of what happened with crowd financing. You know, we made this, I love that product. I think it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I love the way it works. Like, I love the protocol. It's simple, it's elegant. But for a bunch of reasons, no one uses it. And so you have to make a painful decision to just move on. That's pretty much, I would say we were about 30 days or so away from doing that with Hypersub. I don't know what else, you know, I wish I could give better advice, but like, you know, this is the hard part about doing a startup. There's this like meme, you know, where you see the guy digging underground and he's dug this big tunnel. And he's like, you know, just one more, you know, swing of the hammer or swing of the axe away from the striking gold, but he turns around and gives up and he walks away. And then in the frame below, you know, he breaks through and he gets the gold. And I think this is the like, this is the house of mirrors that all startup founders are in at all times, which is you hear these legendary stories of like Airbnb, where they just had this staunch commitment to their vision, despite everybody telling them it was a bad idea and they shouldn't do it. They just were like, no, no, this is the future. And then they just kept going and they built, you know, this billion-dollar empire. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the success story. The flip side of that is the founder who you never hear about, who's too stubborn to pivot, who's too stubborn to like change course, and they're just grinding away in a direction that really nobody is ever going to care about. Mm-hmm. You know, which one, you know, where are you in this journey? It's so hard to tell. And so I think like, yeah, doing everything you can to get information, to figure out, like, you know, to orient, to be like, okay, do I need to just keep grinding? Am I talking to the wrong people? Or is this just like a fundamentally flawed idea? I think like it's a kind of a personal thing for every founder, and the differentiating factor is conviction, you know, like, so I don't know. I think I this is my own, I question this with myself sometimes. It's like, I think that really, really smart people are rarely the kind of people who have the kind of stubbornness to just keep going, because they'll say, you know, they'll have low ego and they're truth seeking. And so they go, well, I've talked to people and they don't want this, and I'm not going to take it personally. Clearly I didn't give the market what it wants. I'm going to move on. Like, very rational, very smart. And I think like, you know, the founder, like the kind of hardcore, like, fuck this, like, I, you know, I'm going to make this, the world needs this. It doesn't yet know that yet. They just keep grinding. It's like, there's this Goldilocks zone, and you have to kind of embody both things. You have to exist in this quantum state of like stubbornness and humility. And I, you know, I don't know, to be honest, like, I think we just got lucky. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably the truth for like most successful things is, right, there's a combination of things that happen that lead to that initial bump. And then from there, it's kind of game on. I think that's probably what happened with us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's definitely a lot of gems in there. The one thing that I wanted to echo is this idea of like protocol and client. You know, you talked about like Farcaster as an example. And I would agree that, you know, Farcaster as a protocol actually is quite successful. There's a lot of projects building on it, but I don't think that it necessarily got close to that success without first having focused on building out a client, which is Warpcast.
Oh yeah.
You know, I think its client has shown to be a tremendous like aggregator of ideas, really through a lot of its features like group chats and channels. People have been able to organize. I know that's true for me. Like when I think about what am I going to build, whether it's how we're going to continue to distribute or maximize the distribution of our content for Crypto Sapiens, a channel, right? Group chats, hypersub incoming. So alpha there for sure. Then looking at how like I can actually build something of value for the Farcaster community. A channel usually is the way that I've seen this play out. As you say, I'm creating a channel. Anybody who's interested in this idea, join this channel. Let's talk about the problems. And then based on that feedback, which is without a product, really with like a napkin sketch, I can go and actually build something. I think Warpcast as a client has been a facilitator to the success of Farcaster as a protocol.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and, you know, I think what they're doing is extraordinarily difficult. And I'm not sure that too many teams can do that. Like that team is one of the best teams in crypto. It's such a stacked gangster team. And what they're doing is so ambitious, you know, both in terms of like the vision, but like how they're doing it. Like they're having to build Warpcast, which is its own universe of challenges, you know, and problems to solve. And they're using the information that they're gaining from that process to inform the design of the Farcaster protocol. Like, and then building that and shipping that. And so it's like that's just an extraordinary undertaking. And it's not at all what I would advise to like a three-person team that just raised like a seed round or whatever, you know, like I just don't want to work that way. I think that if we tried to do that, we would crash and burn. You know, I think of what we're doing is more of like a, as this kind of like a halfway between hardware and software. You know, we're not like in the EVM, you can kind of think of as being a piece of hardware. It's this global computer that kind of anybody can pay to use. And when you put a program on that computer, that's what a smart contract is. So like, you know, like, yes, you can have versions, you know, if you want, you can have, you know, mutable kind of upgradable contract. But when you put something on there, it's more or less fixed. So it's kind of like firmware in a way. It's not, you know, firmware is like way harder. But it's easier than that, but it's also a lot harder than just pure software. So like, I don't know, I think of it as being this like middle ground. And for us, the best way is really to just like, you know, make the contract, make the protocol, put it on chain, make the client, gather information, repeat. Trying to do that all at the same time, you know, for our team size, like I don't think that that would be a winning strategy for us. And I haven't seen that work for anybody else, you know?
Yeah, no, I think those are all valuable insights for sure. And I mean, obviously coming from you and what you've built with Fabric, I mean, and if you, anybody who's interested with fabric.xyz, I believe, you can actually see the tech stack at play too, which I think is really cool. First of all, before I even get into the stack, I do want to recognize your superior design talents, because your website, I get like envy, like website envy, if that's a real thing, because I'm like, this is so cool. Like everything from just how simple it is, but also how beautiful it is, and just the navigation, like things make sense. I want to give you, you know, your flowers for putting that together, but also to connect the story, you know, with the different elements of what comprises Fabric, right? Starting with, I believe it's called the STP protocol, which is
that's what powers Hypersub.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. It's that protocol. That's right.
Exactly, and then Hypersub and then CrowdFi, which I think we'll have its day. I think it's just a matter of time. It's the discovery cycle is a little sluggish and slow, but I think both as creators find the work that's being done with Fabric and the success that people are having with Hypersub, I think that there's an opportunity there. I personally, like I said, I'm looking at both Hypersub and CrowdFi. Hypersub, I think, makes perfect sense for a creator or a creator platform like CryptoSapiens. But I'm also, as a creator that has problems with distribution and engaging fans and rewarding them for their active, you know, their loyalty, if you will, I'm building something else and something that's built being built directly to serve the Farcaster community, at least for building communities on Farcaster. That's called FarDrops. And I've created a channel there. So if you're interested in like digging into that, go check it out. But I'm looking at like, how do I measure the attention that FarDrops is getting? How do I encourage people to be early? And how can I reward them with access and other fun stuff down the line? CrowdFi, for me, solves that problem. So I think you're going to see a balance of like creators and developers coming in and leveraging both of those platforms to kind of be able to grow their communities and reward their communities as well. So with that said, because I know we can go deep down that rabbit hole, but as we're getting so close to the top of the hour, I want to make sure I talk about the accelerator program that you opened up through Hypersub. Can you introduce that? Like, what are people able to do through that accelerator? What are you, in a perfect world, what's the outcome that you wish from that program that you just
started? Yeah. The purpose of it, like why we started, is because I think there's a lot of amazing creative people producing great work and they want to be on chain. They just don't really know where to start. It's all a little bit, you know, it's confusing. It's like, and you know, it's like, well, how do I price my work? How do I publish my work? You know, what work should I be putting out there? You know, there's all these like kind of open questions and there's no great resources for answering them. The other thing is that, you know, every creator is, I mean, we're all kind of like special snowflakes in our own right. Like, you know, like our podcast is not like yours. Like one illustrator's work is not like another's. Like, you know, everyone kind of has their own unique needs and their own, you know, and so I think it requires like kind of their own strategy. And so I think our goal was to say, hey, like, let's help people, you know, like we're doing well, like they're like, it's clicking, but it doesn't work as great for everybody. For some people, they like really get it. And other people, they, I think, struggle a little more. And so we're like, look, let's try to get people who are, again, producing great work consistently, who want to be on chain, but who are a little bit like stuck in terms of overcoming some of the roadblocks. Let's work very, very closely with them. And that'll be a mutually beneficial process because we'll be helping them, but they'll be helping us. We can kind of document and codify what we learn. And that acts as kind of leverage, you know, to help other people. So that's like leveraged work that we can do. That was the goal. And honestly, we thought we were going to get like, I think that the most optimistic estimate was like 20 people applying. And it was 125, I think, was the final number that we got. And I was shocked by the quality of the creators. Like, I mean, you know, from yoga teachers and, you know, creating membership clubs to hand knitted like fabric arts to like incredible paintings, hand drawn illustrations, just, you know, musicians. I mean, it was just like this huge spectrum of like really impressive people. And we're like overwhelmed, you know. I mean, and it's not a, you know, 120 people is not a lot, but it was just like the density and the quality was super high. So it said to us like, ah, okay, there's something definitely here and we need to figure out how to scale this. So the purpose of Accelerator One is to, like I said, work with those people, help them, you know, succeed. It's not only just working with them to create kind of an offering that's compelling, but then it's in following through, working with Coinbase on helping them get distribution, help driving mints, help driving discoverability of their work, and helping them kind of like lift off and build like their on-chain business. That's the goal. One thing I've said many, many times is like, you know, our success is path dependent. And I think it starts with the subscriber. Like you need a subscriber experience that provides outsized benefit. You need to feel like you're getting more for less. if that's how you feel as the subscriber, you're going to continue putting money into the system. If you're doing that, then the creator's happy. And if the subscriber's happy and the creator's happy, then of course we're happy because we're the ones facilitating that. That's how we're earning money. So, you know, we take a 4% fee on all mints. And so like our view is, okay, let's start upstream. How can we help the creator make, like provide an offering that does give that outsized benefit? What does that even mean? Two creators that I really like, Young Weekend. He does these incredible, like generative prints that he's done. Seeing that show up in the mail has just like, you know, you're just like, oh my God, this is so sick. Like it makes me excited to keep paying for my subscription. And then I'm going to butcher her name. Let me find it really quick. I just cast about this morning. It's Narisovka. I think that's her name. I believe she's a Russian artist. And she just has the most like fun, psychedelic, funky, colorful, bright, like illustration work. And she really, really committed to Hypersub. Like I didn't know who she was, never talked to her, didn't know who she was until she deployed her Hypersub. And she's someone is like a perfect example. She's just like really committed to it, really grinding and then producing sick work. Like I got this like, you know, print in the mail and that it was like just gorgeous. I got a shirt, you know, stickers, like it's causing me to be like, okay, this is worth it. You know, I'm going to keep putting money in. So we're trying to figure out how can the accelerator facilitate more of that, you know, because we're only going to win when everyone else wins. So anyway, that's the point. I, you know, we're going to see how number one goes. But we have a lot of ambition for the project and definitely want to do like a two and a three and so on.
Wow. That's really cool. That's really exciting. I know I'm not going to say I know. I thought I applied, but considering how crazy my last couple of weeks have been, I don't remember if I finished my application. Regardless though, I am excited for the accelerator to have started because I believe it starts today. We're recording this on April 17th.
Yep. Yeah. So the emails, I think the emails went out last night. So we have two guys on our team that are running it, but yeah, I think the kickoff calls are starting today.
Amazing. Well, congratulations on the success. Wishing you boatloads more of success because I think what you've built and the community that's growing around it, I know I personally have already subscribed to a few creators through the platform and I'm excited to subscribe to more. I mean, you just kind of gave me some alpha on some people that I should be following. I love getting things in the mail. I think it's just such a charming thing that, you know, is a thing from the past, is like getting something physical delivered to your home. And as you can see from my background, I love collecting independent art. So yeah, that's all super cool. And I'm excited for all of it. Anything else in terms of like what we may have missed? And if we covered everything, where should people be following you? Where should people be following Fabric? Give us the
Yeah. So I'm on Farcaster a lot. So I'm nonlinear.eth on Farcaster. We have the Fabric channel, which is /Fabric. That's where we kind of announce all like new features, updates, stuff like that. I'm also on Twitter. I don't really spend as much time on Twitter, but I'm _nonlinear on Twitter. And of course, hypersub.xyz. That's our main focus. So if you're a creator and you want to earn recurring revenue on chain, I think that's, obviously I'm biased, but I think that's the best way to do it. We're going to continue doing everything we possibly can to help people be successful and to drive distribution and subscription revenue to them. So, you know, we have a couple folks on our team. We have a BD, Alexander, who used to work at OpenSea, used to lead creator partnerships at OpenSea. He's focused on creator success, you know, helping them do deals with brands, with other creators. And so, yeah, if you're on Hypersub, we're ride or die for you. So that's where to go. Hypersub.xyz if you're interested in doing anything creative on chain. Other than that, yeah, I'm pretty easy guy to get a hold of. If you have questions, comments, suggestions, send me a DM on Warpcast.
Awesome. Well, Johnny, we appreciate your time. Like I said, we're going to be jumping onto Hypersub. And so starting today, I just wanted to start recognizing some of the people that are coming through our Web3 native platforms. Today is Unlonely. Tomorrow is Hypersub. Wanted to thank Albiverse and Alex J. Camus. Sounds French. I probably mispronounced that. Thank you so much for tuning in on Unlonely. When we do have our Hypersub live, I want to recognize everyone live through our streams as well for contributing and supporting us in our own trajectory of our Web3 native and crypto native distribution. So without anything else to say here, thank you so much. And hopefully you all tune into the next episode, which will happen on next Wednesday.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.